Well, good evening. It's very good to be here with you. Thank you for the invitation to come up and talk a little bit about the Da Vinci Code. How many of you have read the book? Most of you. How many of you have seen the film? And how many of you have sampled neither film nor book? Right. But you'll have heard a fair bit about it, I expect, over the last few weeks, months, years, possibly. It's not been an unnoticeable thing within our culture. It's been one of the biggest things around for the last few years. Huge bestseller, shot to the top of the bestseller lists as soon as it was published, and has stayed there pretty much ever since, particularly again in the recent weeks with the film coming out. Partly that's been helped by the publishers in America sending out 10,000 advance copies when they published it, which is extraordinary. Normally it's a couple of hundred advance copies, but they were so determined that people would get onto this thing quickly, so they sent out 10,000. Now, there are a number of issues within it, and as you'll be aware, there are a number of issues which have caused a degree of controversy, particularly within the Christian world. You'll have heard people who have been jumping up and down, no doubt, on the television, saying that this is blasphemous and should be banned and all the rest of it. I was looking at pictures just the other day of somebody burning copies somewhere in Italy. It's the response that I feel is totally unhelpful. As Martin said, I work with an organisation called Damaris that helps people of all ages, actually, to relate Christian faith and contemporary culture. And what we're always trying to do is to be able to engage positively and constructively with something rather than simply to dismiss it, as Christians all too often have got a reputation for doing. Now, there are so many issues that I'm not going to be able to address all of them tonight. You may be disappointed or may be relieved to hear that, depending on what frame of mind you're in, perhaps. So I'm not going to address all of them by any means. I want to focus in on two or three, but then in the question time we can pick up anything you like. So, let's press on. Why is the Da Vinci Code so popular? Why does it have such an appeal? Firstly, it's a great page turn of a novel. You can't help but keep on reading it. Those of you who have read it, you may not like its writing style. It's not great. You may think his characterization is lacking, non-existent. You may think there are holes in the plot, but the story he's constructed is great fun. It's a real romp of an adventure. And because he writes in these short little chapters, 105 of them, plus prologue and epilogue, he's constantly urging you to keep on going, because nearly every chapter ends with a cliffhanger. And if the next chapter was 30 pages long, you'd think, oh, I'll leave that till tomorrow. But because it's only a couple more pages, you think, well, okay, it's only 1:30. We could read one more chapter before I go to sleep, and one more. So he's very clever in the way he's constructed it as a thriller that keeps you going with it. Another reason for its appeal is the mystery and suspense which are there. So it's full of mysteries, puzzles, enigmas, and of course we love puzzles. Just look at the popularity of Sudoku over the last few years. We love puzzles. And so a book that's full of riddles and codes and mysteries like this is hugely popular. And of course, it's a murder mystery, so it's full of dead ends and red herrings, not least Bishop Aringa Rosa, which means red herring, and it's full of mystery. I think it's also popular because it's a very anti-establishment novel. We have, in our culture, in Western culture over the recent decades, we've lost confidence in authorities in a very general sense. We don't trust politicians anymore, we don't trust journalists anymore, and maybe with good reason. When you think of the scandals that there have been since, I don't know, where should we start, 1973, was it, with Watergate? The last three decades have been decades of scandals. I haven't even counted how many we've had this year. But all of that kind of thing has made the confidence and authority begin to ebb away within our culture. We are in a culture where people love sensationalist tabloid journalism. They love exposés of deep secrets and of cover-ups and of all the rest of it on the part of the establishment. And closely related to that, people love conspiracy theories. Maybe, again, conspiracy theories have been around for a long time, but the classic one of the 20th century, who killed JFK? Still, people are debating the who killed JFK thing. Still, people talk about conspiracy theories to cover up the Roswell incident. What really is in that hangar? Despite the fact that the people who fabricated the videotape, supposedly, of this alien autopsy, have said, it was a hoax, we made the whole thing up. Still, people believe it. Because that's the thing with conspiracy theories. Even those people who invent the theory, when they deny it, they can't actually kill the thing off. So it's anti-establishment. It feeds on our distrust. Is Dan Brown a conspiracy theorist, though? He denies it. He says, hardly. In fact, I'm quite the opposite, more of a sceptic. I see no truth whatsoever in stories of extraterrestrial visitors, crop circles, the Bermuda Triangle, or many of the other mysteries that permeate pop culture. However, the secret behind the Da Vinci Code, he says, was too well documented and significant for me to miss. I find that an interesting claim because it reads to me like a conspiracy theory, and when you begin to dig into some of the historical background of this, it's got conspiracy theory all over it. We may come back to that probably in the question time a little later. But he may deny interest in conspiracy theories, but he does like these mysterious connections. His central character, Robert Langdon, this symbologist from Harvard University, a place where symbology doesn't exist as a discipline, but we'll leave that on one side. Langdon viewed the world as a web of profoundly intertwined histories and events. The connections may be invisible, but they are always there, buried just beneath the surface. The italics are Dan Brown's. He loves connections as much as his hero, Robert Langdon, does. Related to this business about distrust of authority is that we now are in a culture where we distrust any received truth. This is to do with the big shift that's taken place in Western society from modernism to postmodernism. Much as I'm tempted, I haven't got time to go into all the details of that this evening. But there has been a shift from valuing objectivity and truth that's true for everybody in all places at all times to subjectivity. What is true for me, in my world, and never mind the rest of you? There has been an enormous shift at that level. So we also have, related to that, is what a very significant postmodern writer called Jean-Paul Lyotard, wrote in 1979. He said that our culture now, the postmodern culture, is characterized by this snappy little phrase, incredulity towards meta-narratives, which of course is an immediately obvious thing to say. What he means by that is we now live in a world where the big overarching stories that make sense of everything no longer satisfy us, where we don't believe them anymore. So you take a system of explaining the world like Marxism, or Christianity, or Islam, or whatever it might be. People don't like those kinds of things anymore, by and large. This is a generalization, of course. He says we don't believe them anymore. So we've rejected Christian faith, we've rejected Marxism, we've rejected all kinds of big systems of thinking, because we want our own little stories, our own personal explanations. Another phrase that's bandied around quite a lot in these circles is, again, another snappy little phrase, hermeneutic of suspicion. This is from another postmodern writer called Paul Ricoeur. What Ricoeur is saying is that we live in a culture where the way we interpret everything that we hear, which is what hermeneutics is all to do with, the way we interpret everything we hear, everything we read, everything we see, is by suspicion. We don't believe anything that anybody tells us anymore. Because, he says, we've come to believe that whenever somebody says something, whenever somebody stands at the front of a church trying to talk about Da Vinci Code or anything else, it's a power play, he says. They're trying to force you to believe certain things. And therefore we need to be suspicious of everything that anybody says. And I've got some sympathy with that. I don't want us to take things at face value. Don't believe everything just because I say it. Do question the things that I'm saying tonight. But I do think there is some good evidence for some of the things we'll be talking about. And suspicion, if it's used in the right way, can lead us to explore the evidence and to become increasingly sure of what we do believe. So we're distrustful of truth. Tom Wright, Bishop of Durham, says that because of these things and others, the Da Vinci Code is a symptom of something much bigger, a lightning rod which has throbbed with the electricity of the postmodern world. So it's a thriller, it's a mystery, and it feeds this distrust of authority and of truth. Another big element of it is this rejection of religion. We need to spend a couple of minutes talking about this. Because right at the very heart of Da Vinci Code is this retelling of Christian history in such a way that it seems that the foundations of Christian faith have been undermined. It's very explicit in the film, as well as in the book, but the Lee Teabing character, played by Ian McKellen in the film, talks about the need to bring this church of lies to its knees by exposing the myth that it's perpetrated for 2,000 years. But again, this is pushing the right buttons for us, isn't it? Because we live in an age which is cynical about religion generally, but particularly about traditional Orthodox historical Christianity. there's been plenty of attention given in recent years to some of the shameful periods of church history. Martin mentioned my book on Philip Pullman. Pullman is constantly going on about some of the negative aspects of Christian history. He likes to point to the witch burnings, as Dan Brown does. Dan Brown, in fact, alleges that 5 million women were killed during the Inquisition, which is an extraordinary figure. That has no basis in history whatsoever. The highest figure that you'll get from any reputable scholar is about 50,000. But there's been some interesting work in the last few years which suggests that actually it was of the order of hundreds, not thousands, and that most of those who were killed at the hands of secular courts, not at the church courts. Very interesting, looking at the historical evidence of that again, but we won't spend time on that. But nevertheless, there are shameful periods of church history. Nevertheless, the Inquisition was appalling. Terrible things still happen in the name of the Christian church, even in our own age. And so we feel with some justification that the church, and all who sail in her, are steeped in hypocrisy. That we can no longer trust what people who are dressed up on Sunday mornings and Sunday evenings tell us anymore. We can no longer trust the Bible or the church or anything else. So there's a rejection of religion. Dan Brown denies it. He says this book is not anti-anything. It's a novel. Well, yes, it is a novel. But it is hard to support the claim that it's not anti-anything when it has quotes like this in it. This is Lee Teabing, the Grail scholar, speaking again. What about those who look at the cruelty in the world and say, where is God today? Those who look at church scandals and ask, who are these men who claim to speak the truth about Christ and yet lie to cover up the sexual abuse of children by their own priests? It is a shame on the church. Something that the church needs to sort out, those kinds of issues. But it is one example of many where Dan Brown has got plenty of negative things to say about the church. How about this one? For 2,000 years, the church has rained oppression and atrocity upon mankind. This is from the film, incidentally. Crushed passion and idea alike, all in the name of that walking God. Proof of Jesus' mortality would put an end to all that suffering, drive this church of lies to its knees. The living heir must be revealed. Jesus must be shown for what he was, not miraculous, simply man. The dark con must be exposed. Mankind can finally be set free, and we can do it, Robert. And he says this isn't an anti-church novel. It sounds rather like it. Here's Lee Teabing again. The strongest statements on this do come from him. And where they're discussing the Christian history as recorded in the Bible and come down through church history, Teabing says, almost everything our fathers have taught us about Christ is false. That's a fairly severe accusation. And we could ignore all of that. The church wouldn't be bothered about this in the slightest if it wasn't for this page at the beginning of the novel, which Dan Brown fairly provocatively entitles Fact. And he gives us a couple of facts. One about so-called Priory of Zion, a European secret society founded in 1099. Says it's a real organisation. And then he gives us some facts about Opus Dei, a Catholic group. And then he finishes the page saying, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. And because he said that, and because he says the same kind of things in interviews, as he said in the book, then he does push all the right buttons, and he does rub some people up the wrong way.